This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hulu. Based on shocking true events, the new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, tells the story of a savage murder in a small town. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest, Prodigy, is one of the fathers of hardcore hip-hop. As a teenager in the early 90s, he and his partner Havoc found an East Coast answer to the emerging West Coast gangster sound. As Mobb Deep, their tone was dark, eerie, and minimal, and their lyrics were cold and brutal. They didn't yell because they didn't need to. Their words spoke for themselves. Let's take a listen to Prodigy's opening verse from Shook Ones, Part 2. It is the epical single from their epical record, The Infamous. When Prodigy recorded it, he was barely out of his teens.
I got you stuck off the realness. We be the infamous, you heard of us. Official Queensbridge murderers. The mob comes equipped for warfare. Beware of my crime family who got enough shots to share for all those who want to profile and pose. Rock you in your face. Brain with your nose bone. You all alone in these streets, cousin. Every man for himself in his land.
Prodigy spent his life struggling with sickle cell anemia. He was often in treatment or hospitalized, and in 2017, he was hospitalized for the last time. He died while in care. At the time, he was only 42 years old, and I'm replaying my interview with him, not because there is a, you know, posthumous box set or something coming out, but rather because late last year, the FDA approved a first-of-its-kind therapy to treat and almost eliminate symptoms of sickle cell disease. It's a monumental development, and when I read about it, I immediately thought about Prodigy. Had it been available to him 5 or 10 years ago, he might still be alive today. When I talked with him in 2011, he had just written an autobiography, My Infamous Life. Let's get into our conversation, and by the way, our show back then was still called The Sound of Young America. Prodigy, welcome to The Sound of Young America. How are you?
How you doing, man? Thank you. I'm doing good. I'm doing real good.
One of the key issues in your book and in your life is that you have sickle cell anemia. And I wonder if you could, before we start getting into the story of your life, just tell us, for starters, what that is.
Well, sickle cell anemia is an hereditary disease that's passed down from, you know, your mother and father. And basically, it's like a rare blood disorder where your blood cells change from a round shape, you know, normal round blood cell shape, to a sickle shape, and they start interlocking with each other, and it causes clotting, and it causes pain wherever that happens at. And it's like a domino effect. It just spreads out throughout your body, and the pain increases, and it gets progressively worse if you don't take care of it right away. As soon as you feel the pain, you're supposed to go to the hospital or take pain medication for it.
What's the first time that you remember having a sickle cell attack?
You know, I was real young, so I really didn't have a full understanding of what I was going through. I knew I had something. I wasn't like other kids because my parents, they told me, you know, you got sickle cell. And, you know, all I knew, I was just in crazy pain, and that's all I knew. You know, it was just that pain, and I want to get better. I want to feel good.
How did it affect your life, especially as a kid?
It made me a real angry kid. I was angry at God, you know, and I used to sit there and pray to God, like, please take this pain away. But it's like, you know, it was nothing magical happening, nothing. It was nothing there, basically. I felt like my prayers were not being answered, you know, and it made me real moody. I had like an attitude problem growing up as a young child.
You grew up in an interesting circumstance. You sort of grew up in a bunch of different worlds all at once. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about your grandmother and grandfather with whom you spent a lot of time, and also about your mother and father.
Yeah, my grandmother and my grandfather, they actually met at the Cotton Club in Harlem. My grandmother was one of the first Cotton Club dancers, and my grandfather was a jazz musician, so he played in the band at the Cotton Club. So, you know, that's how they met, and they got married and all that. And my grandmother actually started a business in the basement of her home in Jamaica, Queens. She started a dance school business. And my grandfather, you know, he had a lot of jazz albums. He was in a big band with Quincy Jones.
He's actually a member of the Jazz Hall of Fame.
Yeah, he's in the Jazz Hall of Fame. And, you know, growing up, I just saw a lot of famous people come into the house to see him. Like, you know, famous jazz musicians like Dizzy Gillespie and, you know, Frank Foster, you know, just different people like that. And, I grew up around all of their show business.
Your folks had both also been in show business and in the music industry themselves. Your father sang with a doo-wop group called the Chanters, and your mother was a member of the Phil Spector group, the Crystals, although she joined shortly after they had their biggest string of hits.
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely crazy, you know what I mean, to see all the, hear all the stories, you know, that my mother used to tell me about, you know, touring with the Supremes, Diana Ross, and the snakes in the industry, like that'll try to rob you, you know, for your credit and your money and all that.
She worked for Phil Spector, who's basically one of the all-time kings of the questionable music industry guys.
Yeah, exactly. So she's been through it, you know. She's been through doing a lot of work and getting a little for it. You know, and my father, you know, he was in that group, the Channers. They had a couple of lukewarm records, but I think they never really took off like that, you know what I mean? But they still had the experience in the music industry. And, so, you know, the whole business was just always in my family, and I grew up around that. And I saw a lot. I learned a lot at an early age about show business, about how to put on a show, about how to, you know, how the behind the scenes works to put something like that together.
Your dad was a heroin addict, and you write in the book about finding out about that. How old were you?
I had to be about maybe around seven. Around 6-7 years old when I started noticing certain things about my father. You know, just little strange ways, you know, staying in a bathroom too long, going to a friend's house and telling me to wait in one room while they go in another room, and just little strange things I started noticing. And then, you know, he finally came out and told me, you know, one day, what he was going through and what he was doing. So that was, you know, that was kind of crazy. That was kind of crazy to see all that, and just for him to tell me that. I was just like, wow, okay. Yeah.
Did you even understand it as a little kid?
Yeah, I did. I did understand when he explained it to me, and you know, other family members explained it to me also, what was going on. So, they explained it to me in a way where I definitely understood what was happening.
I want to play this verse that you wrote about your dad in a song from one of your more recent solo albums. The song is called Veterans Memorial Part 2. Let's hear a little bit of it.
Strike me down if I'm lying. I miss my pops. All I got is lonely teardrops and memories of him teaching me to hurt people with my bare hands.
and how to shoot people. I remember me and him stuck a jewelry store. He did the sticking. I was in a getaway car. Pops came out with a big bag full of jewelry. We had a high-speed chase with Nassau County. I was 8 years old. My pops was drama. They locked him up and sent me home.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. You're listening to an interview I conducted with the late rapper Prodigy of Mobb Deep. You know, I can wrap my head around the idea of your dad, you know, just being a general low to mid-level criminal about town, you know, doing the occasional robbery and so forth. But I can't imagine the idea of him packing his kid in the passenger seat while he does it. Tell me about what was going on with your dad that he robbed this jewelry store and, you know, dropped the bag of jewelry in your lap in the passenger seat of the car.
You know, my father, he was a drinker too. He was a real heavy drinker. Like, his favorite drink was schnapps. You know what I mean? Peppermint schnapps, peach schnapps. He loved all that. So the only way I could really make sense out of it is I think he might have been drunk that day when he did that. You know, because it just seemed like that's not normal. You know what I mean? Like, why would you do that? And he was an intelligent individual. So I think maybe he was drinking that day, and he just took it a little overboard and forgot who he was with, you know what I mean? And didn't think about it until after he did it, like, wow, I'm bugging right now.
It seems like with your sickle cell and you being small, especially as a kid, and having to be in different worlds at the same at all these different times. Your mom lived in more than one place. You went to a variety of different schools. That you had to be tough from when you were very young.
Yeah. I mean, you know, growing up, I couldn't always get involved with the activities with all the other kids, because if I overwork my body, it'll trigger my pain, you know. So there were definitely times where, you know, growing up in Long Island, in Hempstead, where, you know, like other kids wanted to challenge me, you know what I mean? They wanted to, you know, see if they could push my buttons or whatever and see, you know, if I could fight or what have you and things like that. Taking my kindness for weakness, or taking my quietness and laid back style for weakness, you know. Yeah, and I've been dealing with that for basically all my life. You know what I mean? When I was young, all the way up to today. So I got into a few fights when I was a young kid, when I was like, you know, around that same age, 6, 7 years old. And, you know, my father was a karate sensei. He had his own karate school. And he taught me a few things about fighting. And he would always push me and make me fight people. You know what I mean? He was like, go fight that kid. You know, don't, and take a knife with you too. Just in case, you know, don't let him beat you up. You know, stab him. Well, my father would tell me things like that. And that's what I did. You know what I mean? I would go outside and he would make me fight. And I would beat the kid up because I ain't trying to get beat up on my father. You know what I mean? I was scared of my father. Yeah, that's how I was growing up. The sickle cell, you know, it definitely made it where, you know, I had to prove myself a little bit.
We'll be back in just a second. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. This message comes from Apple Card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase. That's 3% on products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card, issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval, terms apply.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit their website to get a quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, and their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. Then, just choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Support for NPR and the following message come from FX's The Veil, an international spy thriller starring Elizabeth Moss. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. Premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. If you're just joining us, we're listening back to my interview from 2011 with the late rapper Prodigy. Alongside Havoc, Prodigy founded Mobb Deep. The duo essentially defined East Coast hardcore hip-hop. Prodigy suffered from sickle cell anemia his entire life. The condition led to his death in 2017. Just last month, the FDA approved a revolutionary new treatment for sickle cell disease that could improve the lives of the approximately 100,000 people who live with it in the United States today. Let's get back into my conversation with Prodigy. You started when you were about 11, 12 years old, getting into two things, and those were hip-hop and crime. As you describe in the book, just kind of a real grab bag of various low to mid-level crimes. Tell me a little bit about where you were at that point in your life when you were like 11, 12 years old, up until you were 13, 14 years old. When you were 14 years old, you bought your first car. What was going on with you in that period of time?
That period of time was like probably my most rebellious time. You know, my pops, he was on the run for a while, and so he wasn't around for the discipline, you know. And you know, my mom, she tried her best, but I was like hanging out in the street, making new friends. I was, you know, I went from living in Long Island to moving to Queens and Left Rack City. So I was making new friends in different neighborhoods and learning new things. And, I started hanging out a lot, you know, with my new friends. And we started, you know, getting into a little more mischief than ever before. I started selling drugs when I moved to Queens, you know, because I noticed that everybody in that neighborhood out there, you know, they were doing that. And most of them were my friends, you know what I mean? So I wanted some of that too. I wanted to get some of that easy money, and had the nice clothes and the jewelry that everybody saw was having. And so I started doing things like that. And I actually got caught like the second day of me selling some drugs, you know, being a crack dealer or whatever. The second day I was out there selling some drugs, I got caught by these plainclothes detectives. And they actually let me go. They took the drugs from me, and they let me go because I was like 12 years old, around that age, and I looked it like I was seven, probably like eight. Like I looked it real little and young, you know what I mean? So they were like, what the hell are you? He was like, yo, give me that. Get out of here. Go home, yeah. So, you know, that kind of shook me up. I was scared after that to go out there and sell some drugs after that. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to just chill from that. Yeah, but, you know, I was getting into other troubled things. You know, just started drinking beer, started smoking weed. And at an early age, you know what I mean? Around 12. You know, just hanging out real late, going to parties, you know, having sex, just out there and getting in all kinds of trouble. Where I was, you know, just manipulating things into my advantage, you know what I mean? You know, rob a few people or do whatever we had to do, you know, or whatever we thought was fun to do, you know, to get some money. That was my badass age.
How'd you get into MCing?
Around that same time, you know, there was this producer from Queensbridge named Marley Marl, and he had put out this album called In Control. And it was a compilation album of different Queensbridge artists and artists from Queens and maybe a couple artists from Brooklyn. And one of the most popular songs on that album was a song called The Symphony. So when I heard that, that was like the first song that really made me stop everything. Like, whoa, this song is like incredible right here. Like the lyrics that they were saying and the beat, it made me look at rap different. Like, hold up, this is something really that I really want to do with myself. Like, I want to do that too. You know, I wanted that. You know, so I decided to chase after that. Flowing just like a river. I got a whole lot to give, so I'm a giver. Little at a time, new trails are blazing.
Action is in effect and always stays in. Yeah. Now, you started sort of working towards a career as a professional musician when you were still a relatively young teenager, in part because you had these family members who had some connection in the music industry, and so they knew what the deal was. They knew how someone becomes a recording artist. And the first song that you ever got that you ever recorded that was released was when you were like 15 or 16 years old, and I want to play a little bit of it. It was on the Boys in the Hood soundtrack, on a song by an R&B group called High Five. It's called Too Young.
As time passes, I flow with the swiftness, G. Showing you all that I'm with this. Continuous flavor, you all want a savor. And those without no crowd will have to pay for this. Dopeness. You ask who wrote this? The Michael Biasi. As you quote this, rappers evaporate. Flakes we eliminate. Create the great, then I wait as I meditate. For those who can't keep up with the dope rhyme. Waste no time, but then they won't come to return the life of some. So for now, I guess we're just too young.
When do you feel like, as a teenager, or did you feel all along like you became you as an MC? You got past that point of wanting to be Kool G Rap or wanting to be Craig G and started projecting your own real self onto your songs?
I had to be right after that Boys in the Hood soundtrack came out. I went to go visit my father while he was on the run in California for another crime he had committed. And while we were out there, Boys in the Hood actually was released into the theaters and it came out. So we went to see it on I think it might have been the premiere night. And we in the movie theater watching it. And I had no idea about movie soundtracks. I didn't know how it works. I didn't know they was going to play it in the movie or none of that. So while we sitting there watching the movie, the song comes on. And me and my pops just jump up like, yo, we got a song in the movie, You know what I'm saying? Like, we were real excited about that and hype. Like, that felt good. And it felt like I accomplished something, like, and I really got to see the results of trying. You know what I mean? When you try hard enough to get at something, you know, it feels good when you see some results, you know what I mean, that makes you want to go further.
You had some seriousness of purpose about you. It seems like one of the big turning points in your career is you had already hooked up with Havoc, who you knew from school and was a talented MC and became your partner in what became Mobb Deep, originally called Poetical Prophets, I'm not misremembering that.
That's it.
And you were trying to get a deal for this group, essentially by hanging out around record companies.
yeah, mainly Def Jam.
Like hanging, when I say around, I mean like literally like down at the bottom of the stairs or whatever, or right outside the front door.
Exactly, right outside.
You had like a demo tape that I guess you had on a Walkman, and tell me about when you finally got someone to listen to it who got excited.
Yeah, so what we used to do is we made this 50-song demo tape when me and Havoc first met. We went ahead and made a demo tape, and
That's good, because every A&R is going to want to know that a new artist can record 49 or more songs.
Yeah, exactly. So we made all these songs. It's crazy. When me and Javi make songs, we just make a lot of songs for some reason, ever since the beginning, you know, when we first met. So anyway, we had this 50-song demo, and our next step was, all right, how are we going to get it to be heard? So we looked at the back of the albums, and it had the address to all the labels. So we was like, all right, which one we going to pick? So we picked Def Jam to go to first, because that was like the best thing popping at the time. So we took the address down, and we cut out of school, hopped on the train, and went down to Def Jam. So now we standing outside, because, you know, they not letting us in, of course. So we standing outside waiting for artists to come out. You know what I mean? Waiting for whoever walks out this door, we just going to stop them. I'm like, yo, because you... Please give our music a listen real quick. You know what I mean? We rappers, we got some music. We trying to get signed to Def Jam. So we did that for a while, and a lot of people was just like, oh, I ain't got time for that, shorty. You know, they walked away. Some people just looked at us and ignored us and kept walking. But then it's one of these rappers that was affiliated with Def Jam at that time was a rapper by the name of Q-Tip, and he was from a group called the Tribe Called Quest. So Q-Tip actually stopped, and he was like, all right, I'll give y'all a listen. He put the headphones on, and he listened to the music. He actually listened to a couple of songs out there. And then he took it off, and he was like, you know what? I like you guys. And he's like, where y'all from? I said, we're from Queens. So he was from Queens, too. So he was like, all right, look, I'm going to bring y'all inside the office. I'm going to introduce y'all to some people, and, you know, I'm going to try to help y'all. So that was a major turning point for us. You know, we were inside. We had a connection, insider, you know what I mean? And he brought us and made us insiders now. Like, that's how we felt.
When I was reading that part of the book, I was imagining Q-Tip, like, this is the early 1990s. I was imagining Q-Tip as Tribe dressed in 1991 or 1992 in, like, African print, baggy cotton pants and a dashiki,
yeah,
and all that kind of thing. And you, I was imagining my image of you maybe from like the Shook Ones video, which came a couple years later, but a little skinny kid in the street fashion of that time, which was more about looking grimy than anything else. And I was imagining the two of you going up there, and what an unlikely pair you were.
Yeah, I mean, you know, our style wasn't too different at that time, because at that time, you know, like, our name was Poetical Prophets, you know what I mean? So, you know, that's like was the little phase that we were going through, you know, at that time. You had this rap group called the X-Clan, you had this rap group, you know, the Tribe Called Quest. So a lot of it was like real conscious rap about, you know, the black culture and you know, being aware of your culture and all that. So people were rocking African medallions and different stuff.
Were you rhyming about that kind of stuff?
Now, we weren't actually rhyming about that stuff, but that was like the style at that time. Like, we were rocking, we had African medallions, you know what I mean? Sometimes that was the trend at that time. That was the most popular trend, was the African medallions and, like, you know, certain shirts and, like, African canes. Like, a lot of people had that back in the days. So, you know, we wasn't too far from what Q-Tip was doing, you know what I mean? But we were definitely different. We weren't that style, really, you know what I mean? We were just, you know, we would just throw on some of the trendy stuff at the time, maybe, you know what I mean? But that wasn't really our style, really, what we were about and what we represented in life, and what our actions in life didn't really match that, you know what I mean?
We'll have more with the late Prodigy when we come back from a break. Stay with us. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Sell without needing to code or design. Just bring your best ideas and Shopify will help you open up shop.
Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR.
From the Twisted Minds that brought you The Adventure Zone, Balance and Amnesty and Graduation and Ethersea and Steeplechase and Ultraspace and all the other ones, the McElroy brothers and dad are proud to reveal a bold vision for the future of actual play podcasting. It's called The Adventure Zone versus Dracula.
Yeah, we're going to kill Dracula's
ass. We haven't recorded all of it yet. We will attempt to kill Dracula's ass.
The Adventure Zone versus Dracula.
Yes, a season I will be running using the D&D 5th edition rule set. And there's two episodes out for you to listen to right now. We hope you will join us. Same bat time, same bat channel.
I see what you did there.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. You're listening to an interview I conducted with the late rapper Prodigy of Mobb Deep. You signed a record deal as a teenager and put out an album that flopped. It didn't flop colossally, but it was not a success, and you got dropped not that long after it came out. You had some minor regional hits and so on, but you were essentially back at zero. And I wondered, as I was reading your book, whether you thought about doing something else with your life, or whether it was always the plan that it was going to be you and Havoc and Mobb Deep and the music industry that was going to be your future.
Yeah, when we put out our first album and then we had got dropped, because it didn't do good. It was like devastating to us. We were like, no, this can't be happening. We were like, why did this happen? And we really had to recalibrate ourselves and really pull ourselves back down to earth and figure out why that just happened to us. And once we figured it out, you know, it was like, okay, this is how you fix it. You know what I mean? This is what we did wrong. And this is how you fix it. So that's what we did. We just immediately got to work on fixing it, because we knew this is what we wanted to do with our life. You know, this is the music that we love and that we live. And we ain't want nothing else. It was this or nothing. Like, that was our attitude at that time. It was this or nothing. We don't want nothing else. So we had to fix the problem.
You ended up making this record called The Infamous, and we heard earlier Shook One's Part 2, but let's hear another one of the most noteworthy tracks from that album, Survival of the Fittest.
There's a war going on outside, no man is safe from. You could run, but you can't hide forever from these streets that we done took. You walking with your head down, scared to look. You shook, cause ain't no such things as halfway crooks. They never around when the beef cooks. In my part of town, it's similar to Vietnam. Now we all grown up and old and beyond the cops' control. They better had a riot gear ready, trying to back me and get rock steady. By the Mac 1 double, I touch you and leave you with not much to go home with. My skin is thick, cause I'll be up in the mix of action. If I'm not at home, puffin' live, relaxing. New York got it again in the press, so I wear a slug proof underneath my guest. God bless my soul before I put my foot down and begin to stroll into the drama I built. And all unfinished beef, you will soon be killed. Put us together, it's like mixing vodka and milk. I'm going out blasting, taking my enemies with me. And if not, they scar, so they will never forget me. Lord, forgive me, the Hennessy got me not knowing how to act. I'm falling and I can't turn back. Or maybe it's the words from my man Killer Black that I can't say, so what's left the untold fact. Until my death, my goals to stay alive. Survival of the fit, only the strong survive.
Yo, we live in this till the day that we die. Survival of the fit, only the strong survive. We live in this till the day that we die.
As I was revisiting The Infamous, I was thinking about how different it felt from other things that were out at the time. And by the time this record dropped, there were other people talking about street life on record, you know, especially West Coast, at the time, so-called gangster rappers. Mm-hmm. But there was something very different about the tone of what you guys were talking about, in that
if I listen to a West Coast gangster record from the early 1990s, it's sort of gleeful in a way, and it's like an adventure. It's like a movie that's exaggerated, like a blaxploitation movie or something. And when I listen to your records from that time, they're dark, and I guess I would say kind of sad. They feel kind of sad to me.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely had that element to it. I think the reason behind that was because, number one, you know, the environment that we were in, and then, you know, that we came up in, where we spent our time at, you know, where we live, basically, is, you know, it's serious, man. There's a lot of crime, murder, drugs, poverty. It's crazy, you know. Poverty pushed people to do a lot of wild things. So, you know, coming from that whole element right there, and also Queensbridge, you know, that project's right there, you know, that's the biggest projects in America. And it's like, it's something real special about that hood, is that a lot of trends, you know, came from that hood. We started a lot of trends. Like, we created a lot of slang, styles of dress, even the way our beats sound, you know what I mean? When we really got down to it and mastered our sound and our production skills, our sound was like real sinister and dark and evil sounding almost. Because of that, you know, the lyrics that go on top of it, we're going to write something that matches the sound of the beat. And it's only natural that it's going to come out matching that sound. You know, and the whole lifestyle that we were living. And you know, of course, like the new slang that people really never heard, and all the new styles and all the stuff that, you know, we were doing that was basically like unique to that neighborhood. You know, that gave it the whole feel like this is something new right here. You know, they doing something new. Like, you know, when Nas came out and then the Infamous dropped after that, it was just like, wow, these dudes is on another level right here.
I want to play a song that you recorded just a couple of years ago, sort of jumping forward in the timeline 10 years or so. It's from one of your solo records, and it's called Mac 10 Handle.
Okay.
I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about the place you were in when you wrote this before we hear it.
When I wrote that song, I was just thinking of a concept where it was a revenge song, like, somebody out for revenge, you know what I mean? It's payback time. Like, James Brown had that song, The Big Payback. Like, that's what this song was like. You know, it was a payback record, a revenge record.
It's definitely more crazy than it is karate.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's hear my guest Prodigy and his song, Mac 10 Handle.
I sit alone in my dirty ass room, staring at candles, high on drugs. Yeah. All alone with my hand on the Mac 10 handle.
Yeah, yeah.
Scheming on ziggins. I find myself in my four cornered room, watching hard boil. I feel like I'm crazy, my brain on drugs, my bulletproof on run. Flats, late at night, I'ma look for cuz. Just ride through his hood, and when I see that chump, I'ma jump out the truck and dump my gun. You ain't never been through it, so you scared of that kind of ish. Hit me on a song and say, P-pop a lot of ish. Too much of that gangster music, nah, this reality rap. I really go through it in interrogation rooms. I don't crack, again, I got none for ya. Talk to my lawyer, ish. Nowadays, it's hard to kill. Be careful where you pull that trigger. They got you on film. They got eyes in the sky, staring at candles, high on drugs.
So you were pulled over making an illegal U-turn by undercover police. They searched your car, found an unlicensed pistol, and you ended up with a plea bargain that put you in prison for 3 years. What kind of headspace were you in before you went into prison?
I was in a bad headspace. I was like, heading in a self-destructive direction, man. I was drinking a lot, smoking a lot of weed, real arrogant and cocky, and just my priorities wasn't together, wasn't in order. You know, I was just in a bad place, man, at that time. So me getting locked up was actually a blessing for me. I look at it as a blessing because it helped, you know, for me to see the light. Once you get the rug snatched from under you, you know, I got my career, my family snatched from me, and I was forced to just sit there in that box for 3 years and think about what I did and how selfish I was and all that, and how foolish I was. You know, it made me really see things with new eyes, like, hold up, man. Why was I doing that? What the hell was I thinking about? I put all this in jeopardy, put myself in jeopardy. Like, I got to change. Something got to give. And I can't ever come back in this place again. So, you know, that's what it was.
3 years is a long time. Did those changes take a long time to take root in you?
No, actually, I started on that, like, immediately. You know, my plan was, you know, clean myself out mentally, physically, spiritually, you know, come out physically stronger, working out every day and get my body in shape so I could be in, like, excellent condition and read a lot, get my mind sharp, you know, work out that brain muscle and just, like, repair my relationship with God and, you know, cleanse my spirit a little bit, because I needed that, because I was always, like, real back and forth about the whole, you know, religion and God, and, you know, that come from me just dealing with that pain when I was young and just growing up, living that particular street lifestyle. You know, it brought my relationship with God into question many times. So I wanted to repair that and fix that. And that's what I went in and did. I did all of that. You know, I wrote many albums and all that kind of stuff. But, yeah, the most important part was just fixing my mind, body, and my soul, getting it together, like really getting it together where, you know, I could have a future and a successful future. You know what I mean?
I want to play one last song. This is from the new EP that you just put out. It's called Stronger. It's a beautiful song, a really pretty sample from one of my favorite Nina Simone songs.
The moonlight shines on the New York skyline. Midtown is lit up, the city is mine. As I drive across Queens Bridge, I see it clearly from my POV. This is fact, not theory. Yeah, that rapper got money, but that rapper can't walk through this concrete jungle because he's doing it wrong. New York belongs to Don P. You can have the rest of the world. I'm good with these streets, skyscrapers and housing buildings. I know about London, but I prefer Brooklyn. I know about Marseille, but I prefer Queens. And while you hire cops, I prefer my team. I got a powerful army, it's no need for a gun. You want hardcore rap, we're up with the right one. This is maximum strength, it's no need for drugs. You want reality rap, homie, you got the right one. I'm
strong enough to take the pain.
Tell me a little bit about writing this record.
That record right there was like my way of showing people like that I can overcome any obstacle. I got a strong heart, strong-minded, strong-willed, that regardless of anything that happens, any obstacles in my way, I'm going to make it work.
Prodigy, I sure appreciate you taking the time to be on The Sound of Young America.
Yeah, thank you. I definitely appreciate you having me.
Prodigy from 2011, when our show was still called The Sound of Young America. His memoir, My Infamous Life, the autobiography of Mobb Deep's Prodigy, is still in print and absolutely fascinating. As we mentioned before, the FDA just approved a treatment for sickle cell disease, a condition from which Prodigy suffered for his entire life. If you or someone you know is experiencing sickle cell, we'll have a link to some resources on the Bullseye page at MaximumFun.org. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is created from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California. I was actually up at my cabin in the Southern Sierras this week, and I watched Naked Gun 2.5, which is not a great movie. It's an all right movie, but it does have a great part where Leslie Nielsen says, "I've been swimming in raw sewage. I love it." Our show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Our producers are Jesus Ambrosio and Richard Roby. Our production fellow at Maximum Fun is Brianna Paz. She's on her way out, though. Thank you, Brianna, for all your hard work. We get booking help from Mara Davis. Our interstitial music is by DJW, also known as Dan Wally. Our theme song is called Huddle Formation. It was written and recorded by the Go Team. Our thanks to them and to their label, Memphis Industries. Bullseye is on Instagram, where we share interview highlights and pictures and behind-the-scenes looks and so forth. We are at Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. We are also on Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook. And I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
This message is brought to you by NPR sponsor, Lisa, in collaboration with West Elm. Discover the new natural hybrid mattress, expertly crafted from natural latex and certified safe foams, designed with your health and the planet in mind. Visit leesa.com to learn more. This message comes from Jackson. Let's face it, retirement planning can be confusing. At Jackson, we're working to make retirement clear for everyone, starting with you. Our easy-to-understand resources and user-friendly digital tools help simplify your entire experience. You can have confidence in your retirement with clarity from Jackson. Seek the clarity you deserve at Jackson.com. Jackson is short for Jackson Financial Incorporated, Jackson National Life Insurance Company, Lansing, Michigan, and Jackson National Life Insurance Company of New York, Purchase, New York.
The Indicator from Planet Money is a daily podcast that helps you make sense of what's happening in the economy. And video games are a growing slice of that economy, with billions of people around the world identifying as gamers. That's why we're dedicating a week-long series to the growing business of video games. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.